super excited to be here today. This is the first episode of the Crypto Use Case podcast. We are joined by a very special guest that we met in Singapore. We tried to record this episode in Singapore, but for one reason or another, this is take two. So excited to reconnect with the great Raghulan Pati, aka Rags. Rags is the CEO and founder of Cast, a stablecoin super app. He has extensive experience in both traditional tech and Web3. And today we are really excited to go deep down the rabbit hole in his background and in what they're building and ultimately into how they're bringing real world use cases to crypto markets through stablecoin. So Rags, thanks a lot for joining us. Excited to have you here again on the podcast. Maybe to start, give us a little bit of an introduction around yourself. Tell us a little bit of your background, about your Sri Lanka background, about moving up to Australia, growing up there. And yeah, the floor is yours. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Great. And thank you for having me. And thanks for the patience in going for round two. So there's a lot to unpack there, but a quick background on me. My name is Raghulan Pati, co-founder of Cast, which is a stablecoin neobank or a stablecoin super app. I'll explain a little bit more about that in a second. A little bit about me. I was born in Sri Lanka, in Jaffna, Sri Lanka. And when I was five, due to the ongoing civil war in Sri Lanka, I moved to Australia. And that's where I subsequently grew up until I was around about 20 years old. I have spent the last 20 years or so, plus years overseas in different places, developed countries, US and the UK, Singapore, and a lot of emerging markets as well. I've lived in places like Nigeria. I've traveled to nearly 100 countries in the world. So I feel a good perspective of both sides and the challenges that come from both sides. I have spent a lot of my career in tech, both in banking technology when I was living in London, as well as most recently in three pretty notable tech companies, being Amazon, Facebook, and Zoom. I previously was the founder of a company, a cloud company, from 2010 to 2013 as well. And recently, was most recently for the last few years, spending my time building Circle's Asia business. Circle obviously is known for USDC, the largest sort of regulated stablecoin, second largest stablecoin in the world. I decided to take some time off after the hecticness of that, and then landed on building Cast with my co-founder, Dan Bertoli. And now we really think like stablecoins are hitting their moment, which I think you guys understand as well, for a whole bunch of reasons. But one of the insights that I had with stablecoins was that basically banking doesn't work for probably about 5 billion people in the world. When I say banking, like very basic banking needs of how you need to move money locally may be okay, but it doesn't match global trade. It doesn't match people being able to work anywhere with, you know, remote first global companies. And I think immediately there's like 2 billion people that would need something the equivalent of a US dollar account in their phone or in a very simple app. And today the user experience is just not great. You have to either use something like an exchange or a wallet, which is a lot of very crypto-centric. And so the figure that I always say is that approximately 200 million people want to trade crypto, but there's about 2 billion people that want US dollars for some sort of US dollar banking. And that can be achieved in crypto today. You know, a current account or check account, as you call it in the US, is a stablecoin. A savings account is a yield-bearing stablecoin, something like a Mountain Protocol, USDM. And then, you know, you attach Visa or MasterCard to it as well, and a few other features. And, you know, you've got everything you need to basically build a bank that's on-chain. So that's a little bit about me, but would love to get into that a little bit deeper and talk through this a bit more.
Awesome. And we'll spend plenty of time talking a little bit about stablecoins, Cast, and all of our vision as an industry, let's say, in how we can bring more economic freedom and make it easier for folks to access financial services, banking products, and so forth. But maybe taking a step back and really deep diving, Rags, in your extremely successful and lengthy career in tech and now into crypto. Let's start from some of your first jobs that you took, again, as you were going about building your career. Tell us a little bit about what that journey looked like. Maybe if you want to share some experiences, some of the projects that you worked on, and ultimately I think if you want to keep in mind how all of those experiences led you to crypto, it would be quite interesting for us and our audience to hear.
Yeah, I mean, that's the benefit of being older because you can start connecting the dots a little bit. They're not very apparent to you at the time. And so I actually studied economics and accounting in, at university. Economics is my first real passion. Learned wonderful things like inelastic demand and what that means. But, growing up in Adelaide in Australia, which is a relatively smaller city, there wasn't really tech jobs or even that many finance jobs. You either were a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, you went sold wine, or you worked in the mining industry. They're sort of like these key industries. But when I f was finishing uni, it was like the year 2000, and my dad's cousin lived in New York, and he had an opportunity to go to New York and train as a Unix admin, completely different. And so, for those who remember Solaris, Sun Microsystems, Solaris, I learned, trained as a Unix admin. And then soon after that, reached there just as the dot-com boom was peaking. And then basically there was no jobs in the US, but I got a job subsequently in the UK. And one of my early jobs was basically the migration of data centers from across Europe into a central data center, which, basically grounded my experience for ultimately what I did in terms of working with financial services companies, because Unix was the basis of a lot of back-end systems for finance companies throughout the 2000s. It still is, actually, frankly. And then subsequently, the journey with cloud, et cetera. But really where it intersected with crypto, after, 2, 3 years living in London, working on Unix systems, I got an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria, working for a company called MTN, which is a South African telco, now one of the largest emerging market telcos in the world. And they were just setting up telco systems in Nigeria. And this was around about 2003. And some of the crazy things that you learn, because you just take for and assume that people have telephones. At that point, for example, Nigeria had a population of 140 million. Now it's well over 200 million. But there was only something like 500,000 telephone lines. So you can imagine like the huge gap between the pent-up demand between the people and the amount of telephone lines that they had, right? And they had some crazy stats. Like in the first few years of establishing mobile phones, it quickly went to 10 or 20 million lines. Like traffic reduced, like actual physical car traffic in Lagos, because people didn't have to go across the city for a meeting. They could just call people, right? Really simple stuff you just don't really think about when you grow up in developed markets, right? And if you think about what telcos are, they're infrastructure. And if you think about what banking is, it's infrastructure. And when infrastructure is broken, fundamentally, things can't operate as efficiently as one would assume, right? And I think you're seeing, if you take that analogy of what Nigeria experienced in terms of transformation when mobile telephony came, and by the way, they also were in the very early stages of moving money via text message and things like that as well. They innovated way before the West did. And if you take that same core thing, I mean, ultimately, what stablecoins and crypto is core infrastructure for banking, which is fixing problems where countries are no longer having banking that's working, which we take for assumed in the West, but it's definitely not assumed for maybe about 150 countries in the world, right? And I think the lesson from there really is that, like, if you've throughout my career, I think a lot of it has been grounded on building infrastructure, telco infrastructure, cloud infrastructure, now crypto and money infrastructure, if you'd like. But infrastructure can make people's lives substantially easier and really upgrade their standard of living. And I think ultimately, I think that's what we believe in, is that stablecoins can really do that for about 5 billion people in the world.
Awesome. And Rags, tell us a little bit about your time at Amazon and then at Circle. We want, of course, to go very deep at Circle. We want to also go deep about Amazon and Meta. But again, tell us a little bit about those experiences as well.
So I arrived in Amazon basically with a, if you can't beat them, join them. I was building a cloud platform company for the 3 years before. But what I realized is that it's extremely capital intensive and you need to have like amazing engineers, and doing it, we were building it in Australia, is just very hard. You don't have that limited amount of engineering talent and limited capital. But really at Amazon, it was in the early stages of when people thought that AWS was just, built by a book company, and it wasn't built, ready for, I was selling to financial, so you make it secure enough and ready to go and become something that's available. Now, after my sort of 4 year tenure at AWS, that was sort of like the transformational years, 23 to 2017. Everything changed, right? Like everyone was like, it was pretty apparent that the cloud was going to become permanent. It was not going to go away. and things are going to change. And I noticed that those insights, you know, it was sort of a reason why I took a bet on moving to Facebook to build the enterprise business, because I thought, okay, here's another big tech company that could do transform communications. They did well for a while, but then I was like, okay, because of a few internal issues Facebook had at the time with Cambridge Analytica and a few other issues, I felt like Zoom was a lot more focused on doing it. And I went to Zoom while before COVID kicked off, to be clear, because I had a whole thesis around how they could change remote working and enable people to live and work anywhere. And if you think about it, like, you know, crypto and stablecoins in particular are just a continuation of that thesis that companies are going to be born global, borders don't really make too much sense, and then, you know, you're going to be able to employ anyone anywhere, pay anyone anywhere. So you build the technology infrastructure so you can do video, like we're on right now. We're in different locations and it works almost perfectly. And now you need to build the banking infrastructure. And I think that's what I believed in with Circle. When I started, there was a couple of people in Asia. My job was to establish Circle in Asia, get the licenses, build the team, which was bigger than 100 when I left. And I was the CEO for the Asian entity, the Singapore entity, where Circle was licensed with MAS as well. So yeah, it's weird how these things sort of like connect up together over time. But it's for the broader thesis that the internet's been here for 30 years. It's allowed a lot more trade, digital trade. It's not just physical goods anymore. That obviously is, you know, online shopping and versions of it has been happening for a long time. But just digital trade, employing people anywhere, is enabled now. But now we need a financial system to support that, because finance is very, very local these days. It hasn't really kept up with the internet.
That's great. Yeah. And we spot the trend of being first and of thinking about what's next for different sectors or area of the economy, starting with cloud, then going into enterprise, let's say relationship through a company like Facebook, Zoom, video calls, again, the global mindset, and now stable coins, infrastructure for better money, infrastructure for better financial services. Maybe, you know, tell us, Rags, about Circle. Let's double click there. And specifically, let's double click on your crypto story and how that brought you into Circle. How did you first find out about crypto? Was it the classic story of the Bitcoin and then you go down the rabbit hole? Was it something else? Again, how did that happen? And how did you end up choosing Circle? I know we talked about how you ended up in the business and it was a very interesting story. So it would be great for you to share with the audience.
Yeah, I mean, for me, my first interaction with crypto was like, I had a crazy friend who was mining Bitcoin in like 2013, maybe 2012, actually. And I probably should have listened to him. I may be pretty retired by now. but then I really got into crypto trading in like 2016, mostly, you know, Bitcoin, ETH. But my interest in crypto was largely speculative, what I would say, for the first few years. And it was really just after I worked in some of these other companies that I could start seeing what stablecoins were doing in infrastructure. I actually kind of approached Circle because I did a lot of research. I used to just do research on companies. You know, before it was cloud companies, I'll go through the cloud 100. Then I was like, I want to move to crypto. Then I'll pull up like 20 or 30 different companies and just research them one after the other. My brain is like an in-house research shop. And so I landed on Circle partly because like I didn't feel like I could contribute that much to an exchange, because they're more to do with trading and my background was more in infrastructure. And Circle had infrastructure they were trying to build. Interestingly, Jeremy Allaire previously built a video company. And so coming from Zoom, it was like, oh, this is interesting. Like a bunch of video guys have gone and built a crypto company, an infrastructure company, you know? And so they kind of could get that transformation as well. I'd done a lot of scale-ups of Asian companies. And so speculative to core infrastructure. And when I arrived, I think, at Circle, Circle also had a number of other businesses. It had a payments business. I had a business around actually borrowing against your Bitcoin, you know, and USDC actually was kind of like smaller, you know, didn't have that many people working on it. Yeah, I think it's like 500-600 employees. Maybe I had 10 or 20 people on USDC. But very quickly, as interest rates increased, it became sort of like the mainstay business. And yeah, what can I say about stablecoins? Like, I think they've just transformed over time from being just a speculative mechanism for trading, like to facilitate that, to now really, I think it's very, very apparent that they're going to transform banking, especially US dollar banking and settlement around the world. And I don't know what is next yet, if you ask me, because I keep moving to the next thing. But I think in starting Cast, the way I think about Cast is that it's very similar to WhatsApp. Like, you know, it's intentionally extremely simple. And sometimes we have these internal conversations about how do we keep something super, super simple? Because the total addressable market is possibly billions and billions of people, right? And so when you came up with WhatsApp, it wasn't like you didn't have to get distracted building lots of other side services like others did. You could just build messaging that worked for everyone, and you could just keep growing for like another 5 or 10 years. And I think that's what we're looking at with Cast. We will obviously make the platform more complex, but I think people really desire simplicity because the need to solve this problem of like banking for 5 billion people in 150 plus countries is so bad. It's so desperately needed that keeping it intentionally simple, I think, is where the beauty will be.
Awesome. Let me do a checkpoint here. So I think that the thesis of banking for the world and like US dollar banking for the world via stable coins is very aligned to how we in the Crypto Use Case podcast view kind of like what we're doing here in crypto, right? Exporting the best financial systems in the world through blockchains, which is a very good database or technology in order to export those financial services. And in that, your thesis is people want the account in US dollars. They don't want to trade into Bitcoin. They don't want to have to go to CoinMarketCap and see what the price is. They just want dollars. They want to save them. They want to spend them. And they want something very simple in order to do that. No one is doing that because exchanges are making so much money on swaps. Let me leave Circle, Starcast, and actually focus on this problem 100%. So that's kind of like the bar or like kind of where we are so far, fully on. So tell us, like, you left to start Cast. How is it going? What are you building on Cast? What are you focusing on? Where are your customers? What are they doing with it? Tell us more.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're about 3.5 months in since we launched. We've got several thousands of users, and the growth is frankly like pretty amazing. I think I would love to say it's some of our magic, but honestly, I think the pent-up demand in the market is just so high for a simple platform that achieves the check savings card model. You just deliver that. We would like to be 1 million users by next year at some point, and hopefully around 20-30% of them are active. Ideally, we would like to be a lot more than 1 million users, but like that 1 million user is some level of product market fit. We've got a level of scale. What we find is that there's actually like firstly like the use cases are really hard to predict. There's so many use cases, and as we become more aware of more countries, then there's more and more use cases that come about. But I want to talk about sort of like the three use cases that we see abundantly over and over again. So the first one, I think, is that the crypto economy itself is pretty big. It's over $2 trillion in by assets. There's a lot of participants in that economy, and they don't have they're the most underbanked because financial services made it pretty hard for them. They also travel a lot, they're remote first. And so that crypto economy needs ways to off-ramp. So they typically have their own crypto or stable coins, but they need a card or some other way to spend the money. So that firstly is a simple and I think well understood use case.
That would be kind of like a crypto founder, a crypto employee, someone that has like gets paid in stable coins and they want to spend and they don't want to like use their traditional like HSBC Bank of America card. They want something that is backed by stables, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Or they're a trader or many, there's like millions of these, I would say, of these people,
Yeah,
right?
perfect.
And they're very underserved. Then they actually would substitute a large amount of our revenue and spending on the platform. But even though they might not be the majority of users, they might be like 10 or 20% of users, but they're very high value. Then there's a second user, and this user is what I would say is the largest TAM. And typically what happens in about 150 countries is you go to your bank and you say, hey, I want to buy imports, or I want to travel overseas, or I want to just send money to someone overseas for something. And your bank says, okay, like give me a bunch of documentation and maybe how much do you want to buy? You want to buy $20,000? I think I can give you $2,000. And it's going to take you about 4 weeks. And the person's like, well, I still need to send the rest of the 18,000, and I need to send it like now. And so what's happened is that a secondary market has formed in most of these countries where people go and acquire stable coins through OTC brokers or different variations in each country, but they can basically swap their local currency into what used to be US dollars, but obviously taking US dollar cash is very clumsy. So now they change it into stable coins. But once they have the stable coins, they need to spend it. They need to buy imports. They need to, you know, send it somewhere. And the easiest way to do that is by basically bringing it to Cast or something similar, and then, you know, swiping your card with Visa or MasterCard, and then you can basically, you know, spend your money. In the future, we're also adding options so you can actually send that stablecoin via transfer as well, right? Mm-hmm. But that is...
So huge. This one, let's say you are a banana importer in Argentina and you want to purchase bananas from Ecuador. I think you had something with cars in another country like the Middle East.
In Egypt.
In Egypt, okay. So then I need to spend $10,000 for a container or for a unit. I go to someone that sells me $10,000 in USDT. I pay with my local currency that is easy to source. Most countries have a very liquid market for USDT. I enter that USDT into Cast, and then my banana supplier or the car seller in wherever they are, they don't have to accept crypto. They just send me a Stripe link for me to pay with my card, or I give them the card details and whatever, and they can pay with the card. So essentially,
exactly. The
acceptability is Visa, MasterCard level acceptability, and you're enabling that USDT to card for these users.
Exactly. And that means that they can do that in a few hours. Like, you can go to your local guy with the cash and get the USDT and put it on their account. And
do they get cash back for that? Or how do they do with like the 3% credit card fee, right? Like, what happens with that?
You mean the fee that what we offer, or like what they get charged on the other side?
I imagine the banana exporter or the car exporter Visa charge. So their acquirer via Visa charges them something like 3% fee card payment.
I think the thing is that they will pay it. It depends on the company, right? A lot of retail will just absorb the fee, and some more wholesale ones will charge a fee. But honestly, the convenience, the friction these people are used to, they're used to like 10% plus friction, right? Mm-hmm. So if you stick like a 2% fee in front of them for like immediate movement of money, they're just like, yeah, that's fine. You got to remember, we forget this because we can't live in countries with stable currencies, right? But, you know, if you're buying something for, say, $10,000 and you swap your currency for that today, if you wait a week, your currency might be 5% weaker by the time you try to swap it in a week's time or a month's time, right? And so if you tell that person there's a 2% extra fee, they're like, oh, that's fine because... you know, next week, I don't know where my currency is going to be. So actually the 2% is not that bad. So yeah, sometimes there is a fee, but honestly, the friction is so high that they don't mind, right?
Awesome. So this is the second use case. So first one is crypto employees, founders using the card to essentially spend their what they get payment. The second, which is the biggest, is kind of business import, export rails, starting with card, but then you're going to move into, I would imagine, SEPA and Fedwire.
Exactly. We're launching that very soon. This is also, by the way, people want to travel, right? Like sometimes people make money. You know, these are not like countries that are like poor. They necessarily just have bad banking systems, you know? And so there might be middle-class people who make good money and want to go on holiday to Europe, and they just can't change their money. And they change into stablecoins, they load up their card, and then they go spend when they go on holiday. So the third use case, which is really, I would say, the end game, which is like where... I think like will become 80% of everything if I look at like 10 years from now, right? And this is basically that a lot of companies that are born today are born global first. They hire remote first. And so you just think about what you need to start one of these companies. Firstly, you need to create an entity. So you have to pick an entity. Let's say it's in Singapore or Hong Kong or Dubai or Cayman Islands, wherever. And then you need a bank account for your company. Now, the entity bit is relatively easy to build. Getting the bank account bit, not so simple. And so a lot of these global first companies are messing around with like, how do I create a bank account? And so we hope to have Cast for Business, you know, within 6 months. And so you as a business can just basically go and spin up a platform that looks and feels a lot like a bank. You can receive money via virtual bank accounts in the US and Europe and other places. You can send money, you can have cards and all the things that you need from a business account. And by the way, you can also tell all of your employees, we're seeing companies now that may have 30 employees in 20 different countries. I think we have, 20 plus employees now, and I think they're probably over 7 or 8 countries at minimum, And you can basically pay them in stablecoins, and then they have a fully functioning bank-like platform from which they can, you know, spend their money on credit card, they can save their money, they can send it locally because they need to pay rent, etc. And so our belief is that most companies are going to be built, especially digital companies, are going to be built global first. They're going to have employees from all over the world, and we can become that sort of bank and infrastructure layer for them to spin up a company within a day and hire people and, you know, get funded and paid, and all of that can be done very, very quickly. Probably similar to what you would see out of perhaps like a Brex or something in the US, mm-hmm. but imagine that for the world. So you can imagine the first couple of use cases, you know, they have some similarity to like a Cash app, and so you mm-hmm. can, but globally available. And the third one is getting somewhere close to a Brex. And so that's what we're trying to do. And that's the three abundantly clear use cases that we see ample demand for all the time. Very, very repeatable use cases.
Yeah. And I imagine, so the last one, we would be clients, very, very likely on Mountain Protocol. We had an issue when we were fundraising some funds, even though they work in crypto, they don't have crypto investments. Their fund managers require fiat payments. And then we had to open an account for a holding company just for that. It was a pain. So yeah, there's a clear need there. The other thing is, how do you think about the building of that infrastructure, right? So on the front end, you have Cast and Cast for Business. On the back end, is that infrastructure kind of the same? So if you have virtual accounts in dollars, in euros, do those translate over? I imagine the custody infrastructure translates over. Like how much overlap is there on a product perspective, and how much of that is like running two different companies?
From a Cast versus Cast Business, it's very similar. The platforms, it's just an extension with slightly different features and different KYC, more KYB, and a few things like that. From in terms of our infrastructure, we don't hold any cash, to be clear. We only hold stable coins, right, or mm-hmm. crypto. And the differentiation is, and so a user sees a platform, a singular platform, where they can say, I want to get paid in US dollars, I need a virtual account. That virtual account is actually created by a partner who we've done a lot of verification and integration with, and they give the virtual account, it seems like a Cast platform, but the user is actually depositing money, that cash in that partner account, and then the partner will convert it to stablecoins and land it with us. And so the user on our platform only holds stablecoins. That means we can be a much more of a global custodian as opposed to getting licensed in each country, because that would be like a 10-year effort. And mm-hmm. The one thing I also learned from my time at Circle was that you have to either pick to be global or you have to pick to be local. And if you become local, there is incredible amount of financial licensing, regulatory, banking nuances in each country. And there's a lot of partners who are set up to do it really, really well locally, right? Mm-hmm. And some partners who are really good, they can do maybe 5 countries or 6 countries, you know, and very, very rare ones can do more than 10. But I've never seen someone do like 50 countries successfully, right? And so what we found when we were building the business model was that instead of like trying to get bogged down in doing this, and honestly, even if we did it, we'd probably only do it half as well as what a local company could. It's better to just partner with everyone. We don't need the whole margin. We just want a user experience that's great for our users. And the partners can do the work in each country, you know, and deliver us stable coins. Mm-hmm. And from a licensing perspective, it also makes it interesting for us because it's much easier to get like almost near global custodian licensing, which is basically what we're focusing on, and allows us to serve people nearly anywhere.
And awesome. Martin, if I may just jump in, clearly blockchain, crypto, the best industry probably to start global and to export products all over the world. Maybe Rags, your thoughts on how you're thinking about regulation specifically for the type of platform that you're building, for stable coins more broadly. Of course, you have a very deep understanding of that side of the business through your time at Circle, getting the company regulated in Singapore. But how has that experience basically nurtured what you are now doing at Cast and how you're approaching regulation and bringing trusted products to the market?
Yeah, so I would say there's two parts to it. One is that, like, I think the temptation in crypto is to not get licensed at all, right? And it's like licensing is a bad word. I think the view is moderating. It goes to the initial core of Bitcoin being decentralized and, you know, not interacting with governments. But ultimately, that keeps you at the fringe. And if you really want to, I mean, what do you want to be? You want to be like cool for crypto's sake, which I have that, I'm a Bitcoin maxi myself, and so I have that in me. But I also want to solve problems within my lifetime, let's say, and not problems in like the year 2100, right? And so I think the regulation, and I think for us, like me having been the head of a regulated entity before, just delivers that user trust. Like there's real people behind this, my money's safe, they're upstanding, honorable people. You know, I think that's really important part of it, right? But the second side of that is that the regulation today is very imperfect for what the world needs, right? In starting out this mission of CAST, which is difficult, and I would say wouldn't have been possible 2 or 3 years ago, or maybe not even in 2023, one of the things that we've taken a bet on is that the right licensing is going to arrive probably in about 5 years from now. And we're seeing, you know, the early stages of that, but it's not there yet, right? And
so, what do you think the right licensing is? To get a little bit spicy, maybe, yeah.
So firstly, like most licensing is local. It's not global, right? This would be my ideal state. You get somewhere like a global first framework, maybe like an ADGM or somewhere like that. And they deliver a license where you can hold digital assets. Let's call it non-speculative to make it a little less spicy, like stable coins. And you can hold cash. And they have linkages into the global financial system so you can move money, dollars, euros, and everything else, right? And from that license, you can serve people nearly anywhere in the world. Now, we know that geopolitics means it's never going to be every single country, but as close to every single country, minus maybe some sanctioned countries and things like that. And from there, anyone can do all the things you do with a bank. Like you can keep your deposits there. Maybe there's some level of like deposit insurance, although we keep our stuff very safe anyway. You know, there's savings, there's maybe lending. You know, there's something where it's like a global banking framework can be built and it can serve the world from there, right? Now, we're seeing some early signs of this. There's some jurisdictions which are blending digital and traditional finance. There's some fintech licenses. So they're emerging, but they require some work. What I do know is that when I started at Circle, there was really almost no discussion about stablecoin legislation. And within 2 to 3 years, that changed very quickly. And so such that not only did you have stablecoin legislation, but you had it in multiple countries, and each country was making an evolution of the previous one. And so I think in 5 years' time, it's entirely possible this could happen, considering we're seeing green shoots of this happening in different parts of the world. It's complex because finance has traditionally been local and has not been global. Crypto is putting an extra lens on that, forcing regulation to be a bit more global because it is just global from day one. And I think the pressure of like local finance and crypto sort of coming together will eventually create regulators who are brave enough to create this sort of licensing regime and framework. It's difficult for, by the way, I'm not putting heat on regulators. It's hard for them as well, because every time they step out of what everyone else wants, they get on a gray list, or that, you know, that they have other issues that they face internationally as well.
And also they have no upside if things work and huge downside if something goes wrong. So experimentation, there's always risk in experimentation. You know, the status quo is always the safe place to be. So fortunately, there are some that are pushing the envelope, which are, I think we should celebrate.
I would say that there is a little bit of upside because there is nations that are starting to come to understand, especially smaller nation states, that the market potential of capturing a global audience for financial services is such an upside to their economy that it's worthwhile pursuing. And so they're probably the ones taking the brave first steps, you know, even like more developed nation states like Singapore or the UAE, but then there's even smaller ones which are taking even more braver steps. And as they take those steps, then the bigger countries start responding as well, saying, oh, actually, it wasn't so bad. Like, the world didn't end. I can do this responsibly. And then they start following as well. But yeah, there is a future state. I think it's probably 5 years, maybe the year 2030, something like that. But we'll start working towards it. And we hope to be at the forefront of one of the first companies licensed in whichever jurisdiction that is that does this.
And what do you think, like, being a kind of regulatory future-proof company looks like for your use cases? Like, what are you doing that you think others are not looking at from a regulatory perspective? And then also tying it in with the design choices that you made around making it simple, what have you what are you doing from a product perspective that is kind of different from everyone else's approach?
So I would say that one is that we're trying to tie together multiple, we've got an expanding regulatory team, right? Probably far ahead of where our company size and financing is. But also because I think that if you're going to build a moat and you're going to become the biggest company in the world around this, and that's where you need to invest, right? I think there's different jurisdictions around the world, and some are got to do with more like money transmission and being able to partner with companies that can on and off ramp, and some are to do with more with global custody and serving customers globally. But it's important, I think, to have a few areas in the world that almost like cover the map so you can service as much of the world as possible. Each jurisdiction has its own relationships and its region as well, typically. And so that's one part, investing in a lot of licenses. I think we've got like 10 different jurisdictions. We're looking at various licensing. Some are very simple, some are more complex, but we're looking at like 10 plus jurisdictions at the moment.
And you're thinking you're going to get 10 licenses, or you're talking to 10 to get like 3 or 4? Like, how are you thinking about that?
No, we actually literally, I think we have around 4 or 5 now, so we'll have 10. But the difference is that some of them are like pretty simple money transmission sort of licenses, for example, to sign up a credit card issuance in a country. And some are like, one that we can do like global custodian licensing from that covers a lot of countries. So they're for different parts of our business. But one of the things that we've actively made a decision on, which is I've talked about earlier, which is that you can't buy crypto on our platform. So we basically forego all swaps, which is to most people crazy, because from a business model perspective, it means that like you make so much money as an exchange or a wallet, right? And you can't. But it also makes it a little bit better for our partners because we're less risky. We're not promoting, you know, the buying of volatile assets or speculative assets. And that also gets regulators more comfortable and want to work with you because they can see that you're actually going after a utility use case as well. It's very highly nuanced, and having experience in the space is the only way to be able to navigate it. I think a lot of crypto people don't because regulations are scary. And so they struggle with all the different nuances that happen. You know, crypto people take a very perfect view that everyone should have access to anything, anywhere, anytime. But finance is far more nuanced. So you need to know how to slowly go through the different gates and different users you can onboard. We get, like, frankly, today we get a bunch of complaints from users because we try to serve as many countries as possible, but they're crypto users and they say, oh, my country's not supported yet. And, you know, how come you don't support my country? And I was like, look, we're working on it. We're going to get there, but we can't go to absolutely everyone day one, because then other people are going to, people have to become comfortable with us, and then we can get more licenses and expand. So, yeah, I would say, just to answer your question fully, keeping things extremely simple means that we can expand the regulatory footprint without creating a multiplier on the complexity, right? It's quite simple to explain to a regulator that we're just trying to do 2 or 3 things, but we just need to get regulated in more places to offer it to more people, rather than we're trying to do 100 things in 100 locations, you know, and some of it is really, really risky for people. That's far more complicated. And so, yeah.
Okay, so before I ask you the next question, so we have 2 billion people need US dollars accounts, and there's latent demand because they're not being served. There's 3 ways in which they can use it. Either they want to spend it in a retail way, which is like through my card, I want to pay. I want to import-expo, which is a big thing in its own, or I want to run my business, which is a cash business, right? So kind of very, very narrow kind of use case, although they are massive in itself, right? Like these 3 are, each of them could be its own company or various billion-dollar companies on each of these verticals. And then, okay, because we're simple, we're going to get a couple licenses on something that's very easy to understand on a couple like leading jurisdictions, and to the regulators, we're telling them, hey, we're operating very similar to how a custodian will operate. We're working with partners locally. Here is the narrow thing that we're doing. And here is the very narrow risk you're exposing your users, but while allowing us to play and kind of like be regulated in your jurisdiction. So now to the compliance question. How do you have the compliance discussion with your regulator around like, okay, but if you're moving money, especially import-expo in emerging markets, people that want to buy cars in Egypt, how do you know that those are safe? How do you address that question? And I think it's like the biggest like pushback that we get from TradFi people is, okay, you don't know the address of the person they're paying or where the USDT came from exactly. It is not at par at banking standards in terms of like KYC. I have my own thoughts, but I want to hear from you. Like, how do you approach that question? Because that is a question we get very often. I'm sure you have a ton of conversations on that.
I think our answer is going to be very similar in that, like, TradFi, if you want to, like, really deal with bad money, it's much easier to do it in TradFi, right? Because, firstly, like, there's banks in, like, every country in the world, lots of shady banks, right? Like, even a country with, like, 2 million population might have, like, 100 banks, right? So you can always find a bank to deal with it. The second thing is there's no traceability. Like, if I had money in the US and I moved it to country A, and I could move it across like 5 different banks in country A, which doesn't have very strong AML policies or other policies, right? Once you move it 2 hops, you don't know where the money comes from. Like, there's no real tracing of it, right? There is if they, you know, volunteer some of that information, but there's like no global blockchain standard upon which you can see that, right? Versus with all the tooling that we use, whether it's Elliptic or Chain Analysis or a number of these other tools, it is very, very deep. Like, you can track exactly where that money's coming from. Even in the instance of someone in Egypt who is swapping cash for stable coins, you know, when that person, when they go and buy it from if you want to call it like a Tether OTC dealer, like, you can see the money move from that Tether person to the user who's acquiring the stable coins. And you can see where that Tether person has got it from beforehand and multiple other steps beforehand as well. It's all completely traceable. And you know the wallets through a process of, like, let's call it on-chain triangulation. You know, you actually know who has it, right? So I always say that, like, if you really want to move money, like, do it the old school way with, like, gold or cash. Don't do it on-chain. Like, on-chain is, like, the worst place to do it because it's really easy, exposable. We, for one, have, you know, very high standards of AML. We employ a lot of tech to actually track where it comes from. And we've blocked people. Like, it's not a free-for-all. We, frankly, have blocked people. I think we talked about it in person, Martin, but, like, when you're going after a market that has, like, potentially 2 billion people, it is extremely short-sighted and stupid of you to play with, like, erroneous actors who may, frankly, I think it's just, like, less than 0.1%, but it's better off just kicking off that 0.1%, or even if it's 1%, or whatever it is, because the market is so huge. Like, why would you shoot yourself in the foot going after these, like, bad actors, especially when you can see it all on chain? So that's my answer, but I don't know how you feel.
I completely agree. What do regulators tell you when you tell them this? Or I imagine there's 2 camps, but what feedback do you get?
I think now most regulators understand it, right? Because they have, especially the ones which are licensed in crypto companies, they just more want to ensure that you've got the policies and procedures and the technology that you have, and you're actually running those policies and procedures, and you can demonstrate that to them, right?
Yeah.
So I think most are starting to understand it. Some of them will be a little bit jarred when you say we've actually got better AML than a bank, you know, because that threatens the traditional world they come from, even though it's completely freaking true. But they may find that a little bit jarring. But I think the regulators who are licensing crypto companies are starting to understand this a bit better.
Yeah. And the reason I wanted to ask you is because I loved how you explained it, that the place to launder money is still traditional banks. And crime, I think the illegal drug market is something in the like hundreds of billions every year. I think it's like 200 or something like that. Don't quote me. So, and it's been that way since like the last 5 decades. So all the money that goes in terms of sale, like retail sale of like drugs, has to go out in some way in a laundered fashion to finance the whole operation, pay all the bribes, all the expenses that business has. So essentially you have like hundreds of billions of like money laundering every year happening through the traditional financial system. And then you have someone that hacks a protocol for $200,000 in crypto, and that gets immediately flagged. All of the analytics companies flag it. It's impossible to take the money out of the system. And you're talking about like minute amounts that the FBI would never go after in the traditional space. So, and the best example is what happened with Hamas. They were taking donations in Bitcoin. It was so easy to find who was donating money that they all went to jail, that Hamas had to like tell people to stop sending Bitcoin to that address because of the danger it poses. And they didn't say it, but one could guess that they're still financing their operation and they have to finance in some other route, which is probably the traditional system, right? So 100% agree with you, and great to to chat about that. Okay, Emma, I'll pass it to you on the next chapter. I could talk about this for a long time.
just on the banking front, it feels like every day that you see a headline of a major bank getting fined billions of dollars for terrorist financing, money laundering, or whatever it may be. I think just last week, TD Bank got fined a few billions of dollars for the same type of transaction and activity, right? So again, how common is it? Very common, and all of the rules and regulations around TradFi are not really perfect in the end. So, you know, that's a super insightful deep dive into Cast and what you guys are building. Rags, maybe last question for me on Cast. You know, there is a lot of focus nowadays around cracking the emerging market equation, making sure that we can serve the underbanked. And, you know, that's, of course, top of mind for a large part of the industry, especially for folks that are working on real-world use cases. But what do you think about the opportunity in developed markets? For example, the United States, Europe, you know, countries like Singapore as well, where you have solid, not perfect, but solid banking system and banking infrastructure, financial services. What do you think the opportunity for those markets is, and how are you and Cast thinking about that opportunity?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I actually, funny enough, fresh off a statistic that one of my data guys gave me today, that is that roughly 25% of our users from developed markets, but accounts for 88% of spending, right? And so I personally want to spend a bit more time in North America and Latin America, because I feel that actually the opportunity is very, very significant in these markets. And I'll tell you in a few different ways the way that how I'm thinking about it, right? Firstly, like, the global economy is extremely connected, and approximately, this is not perfectly, but approximately, this is how it works. The developed markets are exporting commodities as well as, let's say, like cheaper manufacturing things, whether it's clothing or other things, to developed markets. And developed markets require, so they're exporting that. But increasingly, they're also requiring services as well, whether that's a simple like call center that goes nearshore from for example the US to Mexico, or whether that's going, you know, whether it's like developers, whether it's like influencers or whatever it is, it's a very global sort of services market. But the revenue and the income really flows from like buyers in the US and Europe and other developed markets through to developing markets, and the movement of that money can't really happen in a really simple way, right? And so what we're serving is really this like global movement of money, and for that reason you're seeing that there's a lot of demand that you need to facilitate. We're for example launching virtual accounts in the US this month, and so that you can deposit cash in the US, and this facilitates people to pay their developers in another country. Like if you're starting a company today, like an SME, you know, you probably would have half your team possibly in developing markets. So that's one. The second thing also is that I don't know why, I can't really explain this, but maybe it's regulators, maybe it's banks, maybe it's somewhere in between, but they've just made banking really hard in developed markets as well, right? Before, like, developing markets, that's well known. Everyone knows that it's been bad and it's possibly got worse with inflation. But it's what's crazy is just, like, you know, how hard it is to open bank accounts as people are mobile and move maybe even within the US or other places, right? And how many rules that they've put on it. And people are not trying to do anything bad. They're just trying to move and have an income. And I think when you see something like the success of Revolut in particular, I think Revolut is a reaction to people moving around Europe as, you know, those borders became open and people moved around. They land in country X where they have a right to work, but they can't open an account, right? And Revolut made it really simple for them to do that. Initially, it was like a travel card, and then it became a full-blown bank, right? Now, you magnify that across all the developing markets and just the migration of people, and then I think you can see that the need for a replacement for banking that's more global is definitely there. And at the end of the day, like, the developed markets still account for a significant part of GDP. If you look at, like, for example, the US plus Europe plus some economies like Australia, Canada, etc. And then if you kind of put China's cities into that market, that's probably like 60-70% of the global GDP, right? So it's going to be a case, I think, where you're going to have, if you're trying to build a business, and let's just talk about building a business here for the moment, you can, obviously we will serve probably 70 or 80% of our customers will be in developing markets, but a lot of the income that we get will still be from developed markets. And we still see ample demand for not unbanked, but underbanked, and users that have a lot of friction around their banking in developed markets. And ironically, it's getting worse. It's not getting better. I remember even when I came to Singapore, it was so easy. I came to Singapore 12 years ago. I opened my first company there 15 years ago as like a hold, global holding company for my previous business. And I remember you'd rock up and someone would set up the company for you in 2 hours, and the banker would come to you and they'd open the account. And within like 2 hours, you're sitting in your accountant's office. It was magical. Like, you have an account open, the company's process, it's all set up, ready to go. Now, like, businesses wait for weeks and months or sometimes never can get a business account for, I don't know why it's become so hard. It's not like these are legitimate people trying to set up businesses. And so that market's huge. I think that market is going to continue to be really, really big.
Let me offer how I think about that issue. So the fines for compliance mishaps have gone up insane. So essentially, when you're a bank, you're forced to judge whether someone is innocent or guilty before they committed a crime. And if someone commits a crime and you were banking them, you're going to get hit as if you knew that they were criminal and you allowed it and you were essentially complicit with that. And the fines are, they're huge. They're like millions of dollars to billions of dollars in size. And a bank's profitability profile, like a retail user might be worth from $10 to probably $1,000, depending on the size of the user. And a business user might be like two orders of magnitude of that if they are very, like, unless you're a very, very, like a very big bank. But if not, it's going to be like $10,000 or $5,000. Like, you don't want to pay your financial institution more than $5,000 to bank with them. It doesn't feel fair. So you have $5,000 of revenue versus a $100 million fine. So then if you put that like risk reward in the table, you have to say, okay, what is the odds that this person is innocent or will be innocent 10 years from now? You have to be 99.99% sure. So the null hypothesis is I won't open. And unless I'm 99.99% sure that they're innocent, I will open it only then. And the issue with that is that that's the economics that these guys are driving with. And you can, your bank can go under with these types of economics. So in the end, crypto offers an alternative, right? Like crypto, the traceability that you were talking about makes it so easy to like not touch those funds. And you can probably know that you were actually doing the checks. So essentially you kind of curve that trade-off. And that's where we're kind of like you're fitting in, which is awesome. So yeah, I'm excited with the reopening of the door, given better compliance technology that we have in crypto, which no one knew would happen. I think it was a side effect that like Satoshi, Vitalik, they never thought, okay, this is going to be amazing because of compliance, right?
Yeah. By the way, just FYI, I'm definitely going to steal that answer and use it in the future, Martin, because that's a very good answer. I'm going to reuse all those statistics. But yeah, it's 100% true. Like, you know, and I think it goes a little bit to what I was saying about the future licensing in 5 years of where you're going to have this dual banking digital asset license methodology, because that's ultimately the end game, right? Like, it doesn't matter whether it's cash or crypto. Maybe they'll go to that person who's in the 0.1%. Hey, we can't open you a cash account, but we can open you a digital asset account because it looks and feels like a bank account, but, you know, we can trace you a lot more. And if you do anything bad, we've done the checks, you know. And maybe that's a part of it. I haven't fully thought through as well, but we'll get there eventually.
What do you think is the role of banks in that process, right? Do you think they're going to have the flexibility and the speed of execution to try and win part of that market? We're already seeing some banks, especially I would say in Europe, but also in the United States, playing around with stable coins, SocGen, and launch their own stable coin, JP Morgan. You could say they have a stable coin through JP Morgan Coin. Then again, we could argue about that. But how do you think about that type of offering that comes from a bank? And again, the more decentralized, democratized offering that Cast and other folks that are building natively on crypto technology can bring to market?
It will take a long time, but I think the most of the banks, bar a few of the really big ones, are just going to slowly die, to be frank with you, because the vested interest of like to change is too hard. There's just nothing about them built around it. I'm quite skeptical about some of these programs around building the stablecoins, etc., that they talk about. I think they're just more experiments. I'll give you a very classic example. I was talking to a fintech partner in Singapore who's licensed by MAS, and this is like a classic example of like outdated rules working with fintechs and banks, right? This fintech opens virtual accounts for both startups and crypto companies. We have several million dollars with them from our funding round, which has come in, and because we don't we just have some bank accounts, but we don't have full flexibility yet, we actually keep a bunch of our cash with them. And so the founder of this company was telling me that, they actually have, this is a very common use case, and they have hundreds of millions of dollars of cash deposits from startups that are actually banking with them in their virtual accounts because those startups can't open with the bank themselves. Now, this is firstly, it's so ridiculous because it's like, ultimately, it's all sitting with the same bank. The fact that that bank doesn't open the accounts directly, but opens an account for the fintech, which subsequently opens a virtual account, seems like a stupid layer. But the one thing that blew my mind, which is like just absolutely crazy, is that under Singapore law, and this might be similar in other places, the fintech cannot earn interest on that money sitting there. Right? I don't know why, it makes no sense, but they can't. They also can't, the user can also not earn interest on it. So neither of them are earning interest on it. Mm-hmm. But the bank can earn interest. And because the bank doesn't have to pay anything on those deposits, they make the full whack, like 5% on those hundreds of millions of dollars. And the funniest thing is that, okay, so this regulation created by the regulator, which maybe had some reasons back in the day, but it's outdated now. But the money that the bank is making on those deposits is greater than the revenue of the entire fintech with all the things that it does, right? Which means that you've basically built this fintech, you've gone through like years of pain, VCs, growth, marketing, and the winner is the bank.
Customer acquisition, yeah.
Everything, and the winner is the bank. It makes you just question, like, maybe to answer your question and to close this out, it's like, maybe what the banks are going to do is eventually just keep lobbying regulators to keep them in this protected state so they can basically keep making money with these sort of situations, because that is much more profitable than trying to change, right?
And, you know, I would say that in our little True Mountain Protocol, we are fighting and climbing that hill with stable coins as well, right? You could make the same analogy for companies like Circle or Tether, which have clearly brought to market great products that people need and use. But there is still that question of, okay, what is happening to those deposits, to that interest? And again, as a mountain, as USDM, we're looking to put that back in the pocket of the stakeholders. So fully aligned there, Rags, and super excited to see how things progress. Maybe last couple things on our side. I know we've been speaking for quite some time. State of the crypto market. You have Cast, you're running Cast. You have a fund as well that you run on the side. Tell us a little bit, how are you thinking about the crypto markets for the next 3 to 6 months? What do you think about crypto as a whole at this point in time?
Well, I mean, I started the fund in April. It's regulated in the BVI as an approved fund manager. A lot of it is my money, but I have external investors as well. You know, a few dozen external investors. I'm not like actively promoting it, but I want to create a track record into the future. Now, is from April 1st to now October was brutal. It's an altcoin fund, doesn't invest predominantly, it stays away from Bitcoin and ETH and invests in other things, primarily like projects that I think have a very strong fundamental future. It's been really tough. 6 months, even with like hedging and everything else, has been tough. But now we're starting to see the early signs of a crypto bull market. And I think what we're about to see is just this explosive bull market that's about to go for, I would say, 6 to 12 months, or possibly longer. And I think at the end of the bull market, we may not see this like traditional like 75-80% drop. We will see some sort of drop. But I think we're going to go into this like glorious 6 to 10 year period where we have both a price action that's very positive, but also incredible product market fit coming together. I think chains like Solana and then, you know, upcoming ones like Sui and Aptos are doing some really, really good stuff. You know, there's platforms like ourselves and yourselves and others who are just doing stuff that people actually need. And so we're going to go into a slightly more sustainable, long-term crypto bull market, if you'd like, very similar to how tech basically had a bull market, let's say from like mid to late 2000s all the way through to pretty much now, right? It's like there's obviously blips in there, but it's more of a sustained bull market as there was use cases. And I think that's the period we're entering into. And I don't think anyone really knows how strong this bull market's going to be. I think it's going to be exceptionally strong and it's going to blow people away. And if you're investing right now, like I tell people, like, you know, you should really go to the, now is the time, I really, really believe, because I think the prices you may think look high, you know, 2.5 trillion market cap. I think we're going to, like, by the year 2030, potentially like 15-20 trillion market cap in crypto, or maybe even more.
That's great. And just talking about stablecoin and the markets topic, there is always the data point of total stablecoin supply related to again, growth or a bullish sentiment in the market. And we're seeing that increasing as well. So definitely exciting to see what's going to happen over the next few weeks and months. Maybe, Rags, to wrap this call, we talked a lot about a lot of different things. Tell us, where can people find you? Where can they follow you? Where can they find Cast? Where can they follow Cast? You're a prolific writer on LinkedIn, so I definitely encourage anyone to follow Rags on LinkedIn. But please tell us a little bit more about where people can stay in touch with you guys.
Yeah, so our website is Cast, Kast.finance. And I'm Raghul Empathy. We'll probably put it, link it somewhere on both LinkedIn and Twitter as well. We also have a Twitter page, Cast_official. But if you go to our Cast website, you'll see all the links to all of our different Telegram communities, etc. as well. And yeah, we just find a word, like, super excited to partner with you guys. And, you know, I think we're starting at similar times. And, you know, I think we've got a bright decade ahead of us, plenty of problems to solve. But yeah, it's really good to get to know you guys and work closely together, and friendship as much as like business as well.
Absolutely.
With that, let's close it. Rags, thank you for coming to the pod. We'll do a second version a year from now or so, and so we can touch base on like what's going on with the regulatory efforts that you've been doing and Cast in general. So yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how it all changes.
Awesome.
Thank you, Rags.
All right, Rags.